Our good friends at Johnny O welcome you to this episode. Now, the iconic Johnny O clothing brand logo of the surfer and his longboard first caught my eye several years ago, but it's the signature Johnny O style where West Coast meets East Coast prep that truly changed the game for me, and I've been wearing Johnny O ever since. And now our listeners can use promo code RICHTAKE at checkout for 20% off your first order at johnny-o.com. That's 20% off the regular price at johnny-o.com. Use the promo code RICHTAKE at checkout for 20% off your first order.
Exploring the impact of sports. Welcome to Rich Take on Sports, the sports podcast with life. Having conversations and hearing personal stories from those who have been impacted, built, and inspired by the role of sports in their lives. Here's your host, Richmond Weaver.
We're going to do this!
This is episode 131. Thanks for being an investor by investing your time to listen. We all know that certain people are just built to handle various situations better than others, and Kerry Potts is another example of this. After serving as a writer and editor for the NCAA, she would join ESPN in 2003 as a senior publicist and currently serves as senior director of communications, helping publicize various entities ranging from the likes of the NFL and NBA to ESPN Films and the award-winning 30 for 30 series, their award show, the ESPYs, and the launching of ESPNW, ESPN's first dedicated women's business, and she even helped with the launch of both the SEC Network and the ACC Network. Now, while earning an undergraduate and master's degree from Syracuse University, Kerry also served as co-captain for the volleyball team, being named a first-team academic All-American. She earned the Soliday Award given annually to Syracuse's top male and female student athlete, but it was a fateful night in Italy in 2008 where she escaped a violent rape attempt that truly showed exactly what she's built for, serving now as a sexual assault victims advocate and crisis counselor, and is also president of the board for Pathways to Safety International, the only U.S. nonprofit organization serving Americans who have been sexually assaulted or abused abroad. And her website, afightbackwoman.com, not only sums up the type of woman that she is, but it's also a resource for counseling on issues of sexual and interpersonal violence. Here's episode 131 with Kerry Potts. Kerry, thank you for letting me harass you. And at least now I see you've, I guess, fully recovered from your injury last time I saw you.
I'm having my struggles. That injury, which one was that? My shoulder?
Yes.
Oh, no. I just got the MRI back on that. And I need partial replacement.
That's not a good thing
to
hear.
No, it'd be my third surgery. I've had two failed SLEP repairs.
Yes.
And that, when you saw me, I had just gotten the injection of plasma to try to, like, alleviate
start
the
healing.
Pain. And it didn't. It was so awful that they sent me for an MRI. And they're like, yeah, you're torn here, here, and these other four places. So I just got that MRI last week. And so I've just been trying to figure out what to do.
That's a great way to start 2020.
It's a great way to talk about sports.
Yes, it is.
Let's talk about how great sports are for your body.
Well, I know that I know that world because in medical device sales,
yeah.
I mean, I've sold shoulder implants. I've sold spine implants
well,
as well.
Well, I say, donate me to science.
You're ready?
Yeah. No, like, my scholarship to Syracuse was not free. You know,
yeah, you're paying the price now.
Right. I said, okay, so there's no debt technically, but let's talk about my
the
body.
The wear and tear
yeah,
on your body.
11 surgeries. Like, when is there a good time to replace
11?
Oh, 11.
11
yeah.
surgeries. All right. Yeah. Walk me through the various surgeries.
Ankle, two on the knee, the left wrist, two on the shoulder. I had a jaw, and then there was a sinus. It was a whole thing. But yeah, it's pretty much every part except for my right knee and my left shoulder.
And all through sports?
Yeah, it's just wear and tear.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes your body's built different. I'm very solid, and so soft tissue injuries, like just the wear and tear on it is what I deal with.
Yeah, it's overuse. It's
right.
Repetitive.
Other people are very light in the bones, and they deal with like stress fractures and stuff like that. Like, no.
You're solid there.
Oh, I am like, yeah, I'm built like a brick house, but for that reason, now it's all catching up with me, especially as you get older, you know, things start to deteriorate, and But this is a really exciting way to start a conversation about sports. But it's the thing is, it's real.
It is real.
I'm real about it. I am not going to gloss over. I am on the backside of the greatness of sports. And I can tell you, it's been a rough go. I'm having all sorts of problems.
Were you a weekend warrior in terms of playing sports continuously?
No. After my last surgery, my first shoulder surgery was when I was living in Manhattan. I was trying to play dodgeball in a dodgeball league. We were pretty vicious. And I noticed when I tried to throw the ball, my ability to like snap my arm was off. It's like it wasn't moving as fast as my brain was. And that's why you know you have a labor, like a slap tear. Your labrum, I had a reverse Bankert, which is on the back end. And one of the key indicators is when you throw behind you and your arm just won't go as fast.
Yeah, won't go forward.
Yeah. And so I was like, the doctor
said,
what brought
you here?
And your
brain is telling you,
yeah,
go forward,
I was like,
arm.
I should nail this guy. And I would miss them. I kept missing them because like I had a hitch in my giddy up, basically. And the doctor said, what brought you here? And I'm like, actually, recreational dodgeball is what did it. and that's what started the whole, thing.
Yeah, and it seems that way because I'm a basketball guy, so yeah. I continued to play basketball even after I tried to walk on at Clemson, which that was a humbling experience, realizing, oh, you're not as good as you think you are.
Yeah,
or were.
I think everyone goes through that probably.
You definitely do.
At some level.
But I continued to play, in Y leagues, church leagues, mm-hmm. all of that, even into my 40s. But I took an elbow in the front teeth, knocked my two front teeth out, and I was like, well, that might be the end of my playing days, because is it worth it? I love it, though.
Well, everyone gets to that point in a different way. I know a man who's brilliant, who is big executive at like Goldman Sachs, and he gave up his football career at Cornell. It was great, but he had gotten two or three concussions, and he's like, my brain is my asset. And, I'm going to have to walk away. We all reach our different points.
You do.
My point was being 30 and going, I can hardly put a seatbelt on or use my arm above my head. And when the doctor said, you won't be able to play volleyball anymore, I'm like, that's cool. The problem is it's just can't seem to fix. I haven't played a sport. I mean, I'm reduced to like gentle yoga and walking at this point. That's all I do.
And it's got to be so frustrating that you can't do everything that you want.
I am like the Tin Man at this point. My friends are – I annoy myself. I half the time I don't even tell my friends. I'll just be like, just send some food to the house. Oh, you're having another surgery? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh,
it's
just a common thing now.
Yeah, just send some food. I don't even – it's kind of embarrassing. So.
All right, so –
back to sports.
Well, back to your involvement in sports.
Yeah.
And so has sports always been this thing in your life?
I think physical activity, a preference for that, using my body gave me a lot of joy. I don't want anyone to twist that. But we're adults here.
Like that's right.
That is what I like to say. Using my body gave me joy. As a child, like a baby, I used to climb over the fence in the backyard and like go off in the woods when I was 2. I had this ridiculous upper body strength. I was a combat crawler before I was a regular crawler.
Yeah, so you started crawling out
on
your arms.
Yeah, so combat crawl, you're just dragging your upper body everywhere. And I would drag myself up over the fence. My mother came out one day and was horrified because we just have a woods, a greenbelt area. And I was at an age where I wasn't even speaking complete sentences, and I'm dragging myself up over 4 or 5 foot fences, going in the woods, winding up later in the, just heart attack city. So they put me in acrobatics because they were like,
oh, she's so active. Yeah, we got to get her.
Yes.
To
she's
use
climbing.
This energy
she's
somewhere
so
else.
Strong. And that was the start of everything. I got in that. And then, what that does, I always say, get your kids in gymnastics early. Boys and girls. It teaches you how to control your body muscles and have like a sense for your how to use your space and which muscle to isolate. You get to know your body well. Just get out of it before it destroys your body. And I stayed in it, I think, too long because I was going through growth spurts and then I'm pounding on the beam my knees and growing another 8 inches. And
so
then
now
pounding.
Into gymnastics.
Yeah.
Competitive
so
gymnastics?
I was in gymnastics till I was 12. I was competitive, yeah. And I was 5'10". By the time I was 11, so I was the biggest gymnast you ever saw. I made the most noise on every apparatus. My feet were like a grapple hook around the beam because they were too big. It was like the way I walked down the beam was sort of like an orangutan, instead of gymnasts, they're so small, you see their feet fit inside.
Feet.
Yeah, they could walk there like they're walking down the street on a beam. And
so you had to work extra hard.
Oh, extra hard. And And it was just everything took so much longer for my body to rotate around, and the apparatus would groan, and it was just obvious, you know. Yeah, and then I tore my wrist, and I'm sure it was, you know, a lot of that. But and then I spent 2 or 3 years trying to figure out what I'm good at, like what I wanted to be good at. I knew I was going to play a sport. I just didn't know. I just cleaned out some old records from like junior high, and I have my certificate from field hockey, basketball, cheerleading, volleyball. And volleyball was the one that stuck. But yeah, I was kind of like I was kind of a rudderless ship.
Something.
Yeah, I was just out there, unmoored on the
ocean.
So
when you found volleyball, was it?
It's a good story.
That you like, ah, that's the one.
You know what? Actually, not right away, but the funny part with volleyball is, because I was such a perfectionist, because when you're a gymnast, you do your routines by yourself, and you are told stop and start over if you
mess up.
Right. And there, no one's watching you, because that's not how gymnastics works. You have one coach, he's working with different people on skills one at a time. You're off on the side. So it's about accountability to yourself. So being a perfectionist, you can't lie to yourself. You know, you could, I guess you could, but then you're not a good,
yeah, you don't
get good
better.
At gymnast. Right. Being a good gymnast. So that discipline and that knowledge of your body, and just like, this is not, I have to be good, that like it, perfect. So I get to volleyball tryouts, and I remember the coach was telling us to serve, and she said, just hit it over the net and get it anywhere within that big white box, you know, the white lines. And all the girls are doing this like underhand thing, you know, but I had seen the boys earlier, and so I hit it overhand.
Overhand, sorry.
And I hit it into the opposite wall of the gym, like lit up about 20 feet, boom, off the opposite wall, boom. I couldn't control my strength yet. I didn't have like finesse. And I was like getting embarrassed, because I'm going, I'm not getting it in the white box. Like I'm sending it sailing. And I looked, I was all flustered, and I looked at my coach Cheryl, and I said, I'm so sorry. And she's like, you're good. You're good.
Because you had natural power,
right,
didn't you?
So because she could see, holy cow, that look how strong
look
she is.
At that, sir.
And I'm going, but I didn't get it in the white box. I didn't do what she told me to. I'm going to get cut.
Yeah, because you're a perfectionist.
Right, and
you're
I didn't understand right. what you look for. I just thought, I'm failing at this terribly. All the other girls seem to be getting it in, you know. And from that point on, she really took me under her wing. And I just fell in love with it.
Yeah, you just needed some molding.
Yep.
Right? Get
yes.
some training.
Yes.
And understand that. And yeah. From then, though, did you start at that point, once you started realizing, okay, I can be good.
Yeah.
Getting better.
I accelerated quickly.
You did.
I'm a good athlete. I'm naturally gifted in athletics. Like I'm not a huge high jumper, but I'm strong, very strong, and consistent because of the discipline. I always try to beat people by, you know, teams or other players by anticipation, and that was studying tape. You know, anticipation, kind of understanding. That's how I made up for the fact I couldn't jump out of the gym, you know, and reducing error. So it'd be really hard to keep me off the court, that, you know, I could contribute. And so that was always like that's kind of actually my approach to everything.
Even today.
Yeah. I'm not the brightest star in the sky. I'm not the best, you know, but I'll cover for whatever. Over excel in one area and try to, you know, close the gap.
Through preparation,
yeah,
through hard work.
Preparation and work and work ethic and study. So with volleyball, it became just a love. I would watch film of the Cubans were really good at the time. China and Japan were more of defensive oriented. They would get so low to the ground, they could get any ball up. So you would see the Cubans jumping, I don't know, 40. There's this one woman who would jump 40 inches, 44 inches. She was amazing. And the Americans jumping out of the gym, and not one ball would hit the ground. There would be a woman under it, like with you know, 6 inches to the floor. And I would just study them and think, where can I fit in that scenario? I'm not going to ever get that low. I'll never jump that high. And oh, I would.
There's got to be a place for you.
Yeah, but I fell in love with all aspects. I'd read about it. I followed all the teams. I would end my matches. So I started, you know, junior high and then club and then, you know, freshman on varsity and, you know, all that stuff, and became like the one everyone knew in Long Island. I was the best player there, and just getting invited to a lot of things. And I just was in love with it.
And then was the drive, you love it, but now I've got to play college.
I was new to college. It was like the thing when I think it was like the 10th grade. I was like, it was just a matter of which one.
Of which school.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the coaches start, you know, sending you, hey, you know, and it was weird. You know, you'd get, gosh, I remember I got one from Pittsburgh, and the coach at the time had been an Olympian that I remember watching. And so I was so excited. She'd handwritten on it, and I had it on my wall, even though I had no desire to go to Pittsburgh. I was like, oh, my God. You know, hey, the recruiting's really, it's cool, you know. So, yeah, it just was like the best. It's one of my best memories. I don't regret it at all. So what I'm going through now, I don't regret.
Yeah, when you say cool from the recruiting standpoint,
yeah.
What do you mean cool?
Well, to,
other than the fact, yes, it's nice to be
to hear from all these schools.
People that want you.
Well, and also to have another option. I was a really good student. I was on the whole AP circuit. And our public schools in Long Island are excellent because our taxes are very high and ridiculous. But nobody's going to private school there. Our schools are great. And so, you know, I'm in 4 or 5 AP classes. My friends are in 6, 7, and 8. You know, I got off the physics and the chem train. I was like, oh, that's a different
that's
part
no
of
fun.
Yeah, that's a different part of my brain. I'm going to stick to Western Civ, U.S. history, you know, psychology, all that. And they're all sweating. I'm going to Williams. Am I going to Amherst? Am I going to get to MIT? And I'm like, I'm going, oh, I have a whole other option here. I don't have to play that game. I can actually look at – there's other school – like, you know, it was – it just gave me another way.
Did it open up a whole
it did.
New
Yeah,
arena
it made me
schools?
Think of places I never heard of. Because when you're in that Northeast thing, you're only looking in that corridor. You're looking at all, like, the Northeast liberal arts schools. You're looking out, you know. And then – you get a letter from, I don't know, Campbell University. You're like, oh, my gosh, I could go to school for free down there, you know. And it was kind of nice. It just took the pressure off. And it was fun for me to kind of look up teams and think, oh, what if I live there, you know. And, yeah, so I enjoyed the whole process. My first visit was Oklahoma, right?
Wow.
Yeah, my first recruiting trip was Oklahoma. I'm a New Yorker, a Long Island girl in Oklahoma. I was like the only thing going on that day. Everyone thought I was fascinating. Like I was like a shiny penny no matter where I went. Say this again. They'd hold up objects.
They wanted you to keep talking.
Yeah, say this. Say car. Say, you know, whatever. I saw my first armadillo on that recruiting trip. I'd never seen, you know, just thought, oh, and then I got into Illinois was the second school. I was looking at New Mexico. And Indiana and Michigan.
Yes. So you were going.
I wanted to get out of New York.
Your horizon.
Yes.
You wanted to get out of New York.
And that's what sports did. I would never have. No one in Long Island would be sitting here going, you know, you should look at Oklahoma. You know, because I was saying, I'll be good wherever I go as a student. That's not a problem. I'll be successful. Like I'm not gonna. Okay. So now I can look at these great. Now I can add a life experience to it. And I can get off this rat race of. How great is your, you know, what did you get on that paper? What did you get on that? You know, I think I knew, like, that wasn't my thing.
That wasn't your pathway.
No, I could, but I just, it, no. If it,
it didn't
had
energize
been,
you.
No, I would have been in those awful physics, AP, chem classes, hating life, and I didn't want to do that. So, yeah, so it was exciting for me. That's what recruiting was for me. It was exciting to read about schools. I was so into it and reading about the teams. I even reached out to UC Irvine. Was the Anteaters. I was like, this is amazing. Like, the whole process was so exciting to me. Houston.
And what were your parents thinking this whole time?
Oh, they were so supportive. I think they, you know, my dad was a good athlete. That's where I got it from.
I was going to ask you.
But his mom wouldn't let him play baseball, which was his sport, because he got his front teeth knocked out, which is funny.
There you go.
And
the dangers of sports.
And he so hated that. You know, he thought I could have been a professional athlete. I think he has a lot of that regret. So he was really come watch me play. But he wasn't like a crazy dad. But he would just come and watch me play. And we'd have these great long drives to my tournaments. And they were so supportive. So
so you guys were able to bond over sports
yeah,
as
we
well?
Yeah, we totally were. Especially my dad. Like he got to kind of live that part of his life I think that he would have loved to. But not in like a creepy weird way. And he was like my recruiting director. Like he'd keep my files for me because I couldn't keep it straight. You know, like what I had to do and who I had to call and who called me when. But in that year, my dad worked in computers for like a Japanese company, and there was their economy crashed and it went under and like whatever. And all of a sudden, he was unemployed. Now my mom is a teacher, and they are well compensated in Long Island. I mean, it's a great the benefits and all that. So we were okay. But I had a sister in college that they were paying for in Indiana, so out of state. And all of a sudden, you know, this thought that maybe I could go try a school out, even if they didn't give me a scholarship as a walk on, and earn my way. You know,
yeah,
dried
you still
up.
Wanted to go out.
Yeah,
of course it did.
Yeah, and then you know, in the recruiting process, you're sitting there waiting. I know I'm Oklahoma's number two. They're waiting to hear on their number one. And now the other one's dried up because I'm waiting, you know. And it put the pressure, the screws to me real quick. And then Syracuse came along like at the high school championships, and I just went on a whim because my mother heard me say, "Oh, well, I want to be a journalist. I had no idea Syracuse had none. I was not looking to
you
stay
didn't
in
even
New-
know that they're one of the most renowned.
I didn't want to stay
schools.
In New York. Who goes from Long Island to upstate New York when you have all these? When you have New Mexico? When you have?
You have all these other options.
When I'm so.
Truly right. Get an experience.
So I never wasn't looking at a journalist. I'll be fine wherever I go. Oklahoma had a program. Indiana had a good program. Like, they were all decent. No, I was, all of a sudden, I'm up in Syracuse, and they're like, well, we'll give you books. You'll be our top recruit. And I just saw how excited my parents were and my dad. And I didn't hate it. I just felt like, let's take the pressure off. It was too stressful for me. I was worried that if I said no to them and then everything fell through, now my father's going to feel worse because I can't go play at the place I want. And, you know, with all the things we talked about, and I saw the relief on their faces when I accepted. It wasn't my dream to go there. To play against all the gals I'd been playing my entire club career.
Yeah, because it's a circuit.
My own teammate from club went to Syracuse. We both signed there. All right. Another one went to Boston College. One went to Seton Hall. So I was like, I'll see you guys next year. And, you know, you want to go and reinvent yourself. You want to go and reinvent yourself as a player. You know, you're a certain way when you're in each team, you take on a certain role, right? And the opportunity to go to college, opportunity to go to a new team is to take on a different role.
And that's the same way with college.
Yes.
From high school
right.
to college, even if you don't play.
Yeah.
It's an opportunity to reinvent yourself.
The idea to go
yourself.
Out to the middle of nowhere and be just from Long Island and be whatever I wanted to be, not a book nerd, not all the things that, you know, kind of travel with you when you're – So
you were a book nerd also.
Yeah. I love
an
poetry.
Athletic book nerd.
I love poetry. I used to write, and I still collect rare and used books from the Romantics and John Donne and Edmund Spenser. And I was trying to learn how to read Middle English because I love the Fairy Queen. And I love poetry, E.E. Cummings. And those are all the things I would spend my time reading. I was not interested in parties or any of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I thought, well, maybe I'll be cooler when I go to college.
That's right. But, I can be the popular one.
Yeah, yeah. Sports lets you be popular without having to try too hard. You know, that's the thing. It also gave me that, like, as long as you're good at your sport and a decent person, you can –
Yeah,
still,
you become known.
Yeah, you can stay in that. Like, I'm in the game, but I'm not trying to lead the pack. I'm not the party queen. I'm not dating the most people. Like, all the stuff that goes on in high school, it's just everyone's jockeying for, like, who am I? What am I? And sport gave me the, oh, I'm good at this. Everyone knows that. Leave me alone.
Yes. It eliminates some drama, though,
it
too.
It really did. It gave me an excuse. I didn't have to go to a lot of those parties. You know, the whole, spin the bottle?
Got a match next day.
All
I can't
smooching.
Do that.
Oh, yeah. She smooched him in the closet. And I was like, I was in Las Vegas playing in a tournament. I'm sorry. I missed that. Sounds amazing.
Yeah.
But so sorry. I didn't.
Well, do you feel that you missed out on some of that, though?
You know what? It's what I didn't want that. I can't say I missed out on something. There was a reason I didn't want to be around that. And I think I always tell people sports were a few things. I love movement. I mow the lawn. I even rake my own leaves now. I like physical activity. You know, people think I'm crazy raking my leaves. And I'm like, I only have a tenth of an acre. Like, how ridiculous could I be to hire someone to rake like a tenth of an acre? But the other thing was because I was so big, and I just mean big. I was a big kid.
Yeah, well, you were tall.
I was tall, 5'10", but I was also
at that early
like
of an age.
Like I was just like a big kid, like big boned, you name it, a big hair, and yeah, and I got placed with the boys, Mr. Ketchum. I love Mr. Ketchum was a Title IX gym teacher. He said, "You're too good to be with the girls, and you're not being challenged. You got to go do the presidential fitness exam on the boy level." And he also picked my best friend, Laura Muller. And we were doing the boy pull-ups. We had to do their number of pull-ups and their one-mile run.
Now, did you appreciate that at the time?
Oh, I did because I was good. And I'm like, why am I sitting here with these girls?
Yeah. This competitive nature came out,
but
right?
Now, here's the thing. Boys don't love that.
No, they do not.
They don't love that.
Especially when you start out doing
it. Yeah,
them.
So they would try to beat me up. Like, we get in fist fights. Like, it's rough in Long Island. They're not Southern polite. you know, boys. And they would try to jump me, you know. You know, we'd play Mercy where you bend your fingers and all that. And I would just destroy them. And, yeah, our recess teacher told my parents, I could jump in, but she's killing them. They're learning that she's, like, she's not getting hurt. They're getting a valuable lesson here that they should leave her alone.
That's
you
right.
know? And the thing is about the boys are, at the same time, whenever they had to pick a team for kickball or dodgeball, they fought over who got me because they knew they don't want to lose.
That's right.
They may not want me to hang around. They were not trying to make me their girlfriend, but they were like, oh, I don't want to lose. She's
on
our
team. It comes down to wins and losses.
Right. So that kind of, my dynamics with boys from that point on was kind of more like, they're kind of adversarial, kind of, I don't really trust them so much, you know? You just, they didn't react to me the way they did the girls that were not good at sports, that were into things that we, you know, tell little girls that they should be good at. And so when it got to high school and all that nonsense starts up, I still thought they were dumb. And I was like, they're
well,
so dumb.
Guys
and,
still are.
Yeah, I mean, right. Even I'm like, so it wasn't a hard decision. So I'm like, the kid is so, like, he's dumb. Like, why would I, you know, and I don't know. It's just, I would look at them differently, I think. I think that's what sport made me do, look at them differently.
Now, did you view yourself as a tomboy, though?
Yeah, everyone said that. Totally. If you saw pictures of me. But, I mean, I was kind of that hybrid. I loved dance, and I had crushes. I had Kirk Cameron on my wall, and I also had a fight. I had F-14 Tomcats. Because I wanted to be a fighter pilot. I was looking at the Naval Academy. My grandfather was the one that worked for the Navy, making sure the specs for those planes coming off the line, like he did the blueprints on the technical specs, make sure it met the standards. He was
an
engineer.
That's a very important job.
Yes, it was. And he had every model of every plane he approved and worked on in his bedroom. I remember growing up, there was like maybe 15 of the Naval planes, and I have the F-15 in my with me. I mean, he passed when I was very young, but so I was kind of interested in that. I was interested in, you know, I went and mowed the lawn to make money. You know, that's how I did it. Other girls,
I did that,
right?
But I know girls,
but not a lot of girls.
No,
right?
Definitely did not.
So yeah, it made me live in a different space, and so I think high school was different for me because of that.
Yeah,
I think life
was.
Right now still is different for me because of that.
Because of those early times.
I think as a woman, right now you're starting to see, okay, those roles, those really rigid things are breaking, and they should. I'm sorry.
It's long overdue.
Right. If it served women to, you know, not participate in sports and not do physical work and, you know, people valued the things we did do, then that wouldn't be the case. But so I'm kind of like, I span that time period to now, and I'm glad it shaped me that way. You know, it's not anathema for me to, you know, crawl up on my roof last weekend and try to get the leaves out of the sunroof. Like what is going on up here? You know, I'm not looking for a man to come help. You know, I have to kill a bug. Like, I'm going after that
you
thing.
You can do
it. Yeah, you know, stuff like that. So I think it was a gift. But at the time, it didn't feel that way. It just felt like I didn't fit.
And when you talk about you being a perfectionist early on, and hearing that, you probably got some of your athleticism from your dad.
Yeah.
But where did this perfectionism come from? Other than, obviously, just some of your training in gymnastics.
Not,
but there had to be something innate that just led you to be more like that.
I want to be really clear. Like, it definitely was to my detriment, you know?
There's a balance, right?
Yeah, no, I was not balanced on that. It was tied up in my self-worth. You know, making a mistake was I'd be upset for days at myself. You know, I would self-punish, you know, I'd like, you don't deserve that. You're terrible, you know, that kind
like
of thing.
Like you were telling yourself that.
Yeah, yeah. I'd have this like inner dialogue. And I think it's because when you are good at things, people reward you. And it kind of becomes a cycle of expectation. And if I do this, then that will happen. If I do this, they're happy. If I do this, my parents are happy. If I do this, my teachers are happy. My school's proud of me. If I do this, if I don't do that, then I'm letting them down. Then I'm bad, you know. And I caution anyone. I was the worst in high school. If I missed one ball, you know, I would be under my breath, like annihilating myself. And I remember my coach pulled me out of the game and was like, "You have got to stop. Like, this is not healthy. No one wants to see you beat. You're allowed to make mistakes," you know, that kind of thing. And I thought making mistakes meant I was bad. Like, it was just this, it wasn't great. But
did you hold yourself to a higher level than you did
yeah,
other people?
Other people. I would sit there and say, hey, it's okay. You're human. And then I'd sit there and be
yourself.
Like, ah! Yeah. Yeah, I think everyone, but people have this problem.
Do that.
We do
yeah.
that.
Yes.
And I honestly don't think I really let go of that until probably my early 30s.
Okay. So I was going to ask you, do you still battle that now?
No,
with
I'm
your
a lot better.
Role?
I'm a lot better. And when we talk a little bit later on about probably some other life mm-hmm. things, that would be the kind of the point of which I realized I couldn't
do that. The defining moment.
Yeah. I couldn't do that anymore to myself.
Now you're at Syracuse.
Yeah.
And it's not actually the place you wanted to be.
Or the coach I wanted.
Or the coach.
And it was awful.
What was so awful?
Well, he wasn't who I signed with.
Oh, so it was a new coach?
Yeah, he just showed
so
up.
So you signed?
Yeah, with this couple. And then they got the head job. They were interim. The previous coach had been ousted in like a bloodless coup. The team wouldn't play for him. He was sexually harassing all the girls.
Oh, my goodness.
He was wildly inappropriate. And they just wouldn't play. They just sat down and that was it. They wouldn't show up for the matches. And that's how they got rid of him. You know, I love those girls. I'm still friends with them. They are such strong women. They said, this is... You know, that's how you
pioneers
force
right there.
That's how you force their hand. The administration, what are they going to do? So we had this interim coaches and, you know, I was their top recruit and I really like them. They had both played Penn State, the husband, which is a great team. They won the championship in 94, just the year before I graduated high school. And his wife was from Arizona State and had played great program, you know, Pac-10 at the time. And all of a sudden I wind up with this guy, Jing Pu, in late January, shows up on my door. He was the coach at Central Connecticut State, but very thick accent, really hard to understand, and just not interested in knowing you personally or watching tape with you or connecting with you on any level. He would look at a chart. He would look at his clipboard and say, Putz, you know, didn't run as fast this week. And I'd say, okay. And, you know, that would be if I started or not. You're just ridiculous. It's like.
Yeah, no rhyme or reason.
No,
but, and
how
it's
fast we ran or how high we jumped.
Analytic-centric.
Right. And yet I'm like literally the emotional stability of our team. I'm the one people like carries unflappable. You know, I'm not slamming the ball down like this girl here, like this one there. But I'm the one that's not going to like shank it 20 times. And then, you know, and those kinds of intangible things that I'm good at and people recognize he didn't.
He didn't.
So all of a sudden, like you said, you went to try to play at Clemson and
yes.
realized I'm on a team where I have a coach that doesn't believe in me at all. And that had never happened. And so it was really hard. And that's when I kind of really dug into my studies.
Well, did that also manifest itself in terms of some of your self-doubt that, or maybe not self-doubt, but how you'd beat yourself
up.
Oh,
it was hard. Yeah, it was really hard. But here's the thing. I knew I was doing the things right. That's the thing. I wasn't making mistakes. I was doing everything right. So it was easy to say.
Well, that had to be even more challenging
yeah, but,
to have
but
to deal
I
with.
I knew I was doing it right. So it's him. You know, like, I can understand if I was not trying. I wasn't, you know, I had a knee surgery. I rehabbed twice a day, every day for 6 months. I never missed a thing. Like, I'm totally coachable. I'm totally committed, my scholarship, I would never violate. I didn't have a fake ID. Like, I like all the things. I would never embarrass my family that way. I wouldn't, you know, I'm the one that's like the good kid, you know? And I had an academic scholarship that helped us give our walk-on a scholarship. So they didn't have to use the whole athletic one on me, you know? So I always kept my grades, you know, all that stuff. And all that aside, but when it came to the court play, like, It was heartbreaking. And but I worked through that, you know, and then I finally wound up. It was impossible to keep me off the court. But it really helped me realize.
Was he like, your coach the whole time? The whole time.
It was awful. But I realized, you know, I've kind of fallen in love with my studies and I knew I had other things. I wasn't a one note or one flavor. So that's when I really started to fall in love with magazine writing and writing. I would pick up writing projects all around campus for the alumni magazine, the local newspaper, all that kind of stuff. So it kind of helped me actually realize, like, you know, volleyball is really not in the bigger picture when you leave here. This is not going to be what you do.
You have the pathway that you continue.
Right. I wasn't deluded by it. Now, imagine if I get there, I have great coaches. I'm like, oh, I'm going to play in Europe.
That's right.
Yeah, maybe I'll go to the Olympic team. You know, I didn't have any of that. You know, it was very clear that ending was coming.
Yeah. So. Well, I would say you definitely found your groove in academics. I mean, you're an academic All-American, so
yes,
you definitely
right.
enjoyed that.
Yes. Well, I entered as a sophomore.
Because of all the AP classes.
Yeah. So that's why I said I knew I'd be fine wherever I went. Yeah. So I entered as a sophomore. I started my master's a month after I graduated in 3 years and got the master's that last year. So, I was academically like very –
You're driven.
I was very driven. I'm not a genius, but I'm good enough that if the work – I'll close it on the work and the ethic and I'll sacrifice. Yes, it was a blur. There are a lot of parties I didn't go to. There's a lot – I never had the classes that you could – you know, the whole freshman year classes where people are like half asleep. I went right into sophomore level honors classes where I have no idea what they're talking about on like folklore and anthropology and, you know, sociology. It just, and we'd miss all these classes because of travel and I'd have to go to tutor sessions and just stuff like that. So college was different for that reason. But yeah, no, I was a good student.
So now how has it been then for you if you start falling into love with journalism, doing the magazine writing and stuff?
Yeah.
But you're in PR. Isn't there a clash between journalism and publicists?
Well, that's what my master's was difficult because you sit in journalism and they talk about PR flacks like they are just the devil.
That's right.
Yeah, they're just dirt on the bottom of your shoe. And then you get into PR and I remember sitting there. Actually, I can still see in my head when I raised my hand and said, you know, I just came out of our undergrad program in journalism and the way you're talking about journalists right now is the exact like exactly how they talk about publicists. And she said, that is the great yin and yang of our industry, Carrie, the push-pull. But they need us and for them to say they don't. And it's true.
So do they?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Except unless you're an investigative journalist. But even then, we are, you know, at companies, we are the means by which there's access to information. We're the records keepers. We know where content is. We can service you images. Like, a lot of places, not a lot of stories can get written without that stuff. And but I really do believe, and I always say, in PR, like my job is to serve journalists and to get them what they need. I really believe in journalism. I believe we need them. They are in so much danger now. Like I donate, you know, to causes that, you know, try to keep us at a place of, you know, unbiased reporting and journalists thriving and the industry supported. I worked as one. When I worked at the NCAA for 3.5 years, I was a writer and editor. I covered Title IX hearings, like all the principles of sourcing and reporting. And, you know, even though it was for a membership paper, I still had to do all those things. And I really believe in it. So I respect the heck out of them. And I so believe in it. But I also know what my job is as a publicist and as, you know, a PR person. And it means that I don't have to give you everything because I know that your job is, yeah,
you
got to work for
it.
Yeah, that's right. That's the thing I say, like, oh, you got the wrong person. I know exactly what your job is. I did it. Which a lot of us are. We used to do. But, you know, I wouldn't change a thing. And it was great to get those both paid for. It was nice to come out
of
school.
Yes, to come out of school. No.
I was mentally gassed at the thought of going to school again. Like, I couldn't
even. That's why I didn't go to grad school.
Yeah, I saw.
Then I had an opportunity to be a grad assistant basketball coach. And I was like, I can't do it. I can't go to school anymore.
I remember thinking, I've just got to hold on a little longer to get off this, like, once you get in those AP classes from like the 9th or the 10th grade, you go to honors classes. But then once you're in those AP classes, which are college classes, from that until my end of my master's, like,
no, that's a long time.
Exhausting.
Yes.
I thought I can never go back. I can never go back to school.
You got to have a new chapter in your life, right?
Yeah.
And I wasn't even in those type of classes. Yeah. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm done.
I was done.
I'm over
I was
it.
Done with the whole like high speed education, you know, intake of so much information and performing at a high level.
Yeah. Well, and you're doing it on both athletically and academically.
And
I mean, that's a tough.
I could not let people down. There's no way all of a sudden you're going to be a senior. And yeah, that's when I got the Academic All-American. But, you know, what am I going to just fall off senior year and like let everybody at Syracuse?
That's not your style.
No. They would be so disappointed and it would be embarrassing to me. And like, so it's just, I just wanted the pressure off when I got out. And then, of course, I get the job at the NCAA, which was, I felt the pressure to get a great job. Like, everyone's like, where are you going to wind up? And I'm like, oh, God, I don't know. You know, I didn't actually put that pressure too much on myself. It seemed to be everybody else.
Everybody else was asking you?
Expecting me to, because I had my master's, I finished it at Nike. And everyone's like, oh, you're going to stay at Nike? And I'm like, I don't know, you know, and I felt like, oh gosh, I have to have some really cool job. It can't just be like a widget factory. I can't just do PR for like paper, you know. I kind of think of Dunder Mifflin. You know, they're at a paper, like they're selling paper.
That's not sexy.
And somehow I wound up at the NCAA, but I didn't think I would. I didn't think I'd get a cool job.
So did you feel that that was a cool job?
I felt like it was cool enough. Yeah. People left me alone after that. There was a prestige to it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
There definitely still is. Even today, yeah. NCAA, granted, you know, obviously there's controversy around NCAA and how they
of course are operating. Always
they're always, yeah, there probably always will
as
be.
As long as I can have been alive.
Yes. There's always been issues. But it's still, it's that level. Oh, NCAA.
Right.
Now, ESPN is even much bigger than that. Why ESPN? Why did you?
Because working at the NCAA was like being in a straitjacket. For my personality, it was really like conform or yeah, there's a rigidity there that is not. And I loved my bosses and my actual team, like our director, my boss, and I loved my team, our sense of humor and all those things, but. In the NCAA, it's like if you work in communications, you can never work in any other department. If you're in championships, you're the queens and kings of the institution. If you work in enforcement, you know, you have a special pass. Only you can get to that part of the building. Like you're kind of like the FBI. You're like uber cool Secret Service talking into your wrist, yeah,
exactly.
You know.
Special key cards.
Right. And so I'm coming up with all these projects. I'm thinking, oh, God, there's all these things we can do. I was a student athlete. Why don't we address, you know, this issue that – you know, catastrophic injury. What about athletes that have families? Like all these, you know, and they let me do all that writing and all that kind of stuff. But anytime I would try to, you know, well, I can go do championships. They'd loan me out to do it. Like, no, it just, and I was like, never been somewhere where people are going, yeah, but you can't do that. Like, but why? Well, it's just not done.
That's just the way it's done. Right. Or it's not done that way.
Right.
We don't do that.
That kind of thing. And ridiculous, right? And so,
You are the kid that was crawling over a fence at 2 years old. You don't want to be tied up in boundaries.
Yeah, you have to be really into hierarchy and, you know, the kissing of the ring, I think, in a certain regard. And my parents, unfortunately, you know, it's not always been the best, but like they, my mother would say, you don't give respect to anyone who doesn't give it to you. Instead of a lot of which is you respect authority, you respect whatever. So it makes it really hard when you're like, you know, just taking it on the chin.
Again, yes.
Yeah. And it's like the only reason you're not allowed to speak in this meeting or this is because your title or this name, like that's ridiculous. And to me, those are antiquated views. And having come from Nike where it was like everyone's energy and everyone's thought was contributed, I never had that to compare it to. So, you know, and I got to say, they were great people. I got good times. But like in terms of growth and where you could go and kind of the fitting into this, it just wasn't for me. It just wasn't. I knew it. And so it took me like a year to get out of there. I felt like it was the Hotel California. I was like, I got in and now I can't get out of this place.
There's no door.
I should be, you know, tripping over offers. And it was actually, because how do you translate committee liaison work, right? It's actually not a real job in the world, right? Like committee liaison is not a job that people hire you for, like in a wide, you know, a wide industry of that. There's jobs in there that are like being an enforcement person, you're not actually in the FBI, you're not actually an officer or an SEC. Yeah. You're enforcement for a very specific rule of bylaws. Like, what job is it? You're not SEC compliance. You're not going to get hired at a financial institution.
Where does that translate?
But where does it translate? So there's very, very specific jobs. And so that's what I learned. But I decided, well, why don't I go try my master's? You know, my PR.
PR.
Yeah, I mean, I could try that. Because as long as it let me do writing. So this is writing. And so I called Coach Boeheim, who I had been his assistant one summer and been close to the family and babysat the kids. And Syracuse is such a family, just such a family. And I said to him, I'd never pulled the Boeheim card. I'd never asked him for a letter of recommendation, never. But this time I said, do we know anybody that you think I could talk to about where to go? I don't know how to get out of the NCAA. And I knew he hated the NCAA. So I was like,
yes.
All I had to say was, I need to get out of this place. And he was like, I'm your man.
I'll get you out of there.
I'm the one. And yeah, he said, I know this guy, Johnny Wildhack. That's what he said, Johnny Wildhack. And I said, sure. I'd love, you know, so he connected me with him, gave him his number. And I would just ask him, like, what do you think? Like, where would this translate? Whatever. And John was at ESPN at the time. And his fiance was in our department, PR department. And when an opening came, I applied and had Syracuse, you know, my people call from my behalf and went through the whole interview process and got a senior publicist job because I had my master's. They counted that, you know, and all that. But and John's now the AD at Syracuse. he was the number two at ESPN until he left for Syracuse. So he was at ESPN his entire career since he left Syracuse. He was there for, I want to say, 34 years, 40 years, something like, 34 years. So isn't that like a weird kind of...
It is. The circle,
right?
It stays connected.
And now he's Jim's boss, which is really funny. But yeah, so that's how I got out. And then I got in there. And I remember when I was trying to, my going away party at the NCAA, every time I walk through the halls, people go, da-na-na, da-na-na. And I was like, oh God. Yeah. I didn't really like, but I wasn't looking to go to ESPN. I was just looking for a job.
It was an opportunity to get out.
Yeah. And like, where can I go that would be
something that you felt you would enjoy?
Yes, that I would enjoy, that I could translate my skills, that I'd be an asset with what I've worked on for the last 3.5 years. There's a very finite time when you're starting out in your career. There's a few years you get to play with, but then you start to kind of get in your lane. You kind of pigeonholed. You know, you start to, you know, I've been doing this for 5 or 6 years. It's really hard to be like, oh, I'm going to go do finance or I'm going to go do that, you know? And I didn't feel like I needed to leave the space of being around sports. I wasn't looking to reinvent the wheel. But I could have, I guess. I was only 3.5 years at the NCAA, but it, like I said, it was very specific. And yes. I don't know that that translates to Macy's or, you know, all these other companies. They're like, what exactly?
Well, it's
is
a little
that?
More difficult to get the opportunities because people will view you in that
yes.
specific role as well.
Absolutely.
That, oh, well, you don't have any other skill sets that
well,
will
that's
translate.
What I've, so what I've been doing these last 10 or 11 years is working on you know, I'm very interested in women and girls advancing their rights and equality. I work on gender-based violence in my time away from ESPN. It's been very close to my heart. I've been a rape crisis counselor for years. I am president of an org that helps Americans assaulted overseas. And I've been working on that because really they'd be like, but you're sports. You know, like I've been just chipping away at it for years. And now I'm finally going, and I speak around the country, but now I just did a moderator job for the UN Population Fund in Nairobi in November. I got invited to do that. I spoke out on a UN panel celebrating International Day of the Girl up in New York in October. That's the space I'm jazzed about, and that's where I want to be. But to get there, you know, you kind of have to – it takes longer. At this age, and 20 years in the business, 11 years I've been spending trying to like acquire the knowledge, get in the spaces, and get past people going, "Oh, what are you doing here?" You know, these are all, a lot of them are PhDs, academics, they're technical specialists, they work in the global south, and they're looking at me going, "You've never been to Africa. Like, what are we going to do with you? You've never worked in a, you know, on a camp or done research. Why would, you know?" So,
What can you bring to the table?
I've been experiencing it.
I imagine
we're talking about, but I'm finally there. I'm finally kind of like getting in there.
The snowball is starting to happen.
It is, because there's a lot of sports partnerships they have. The UNFPA, like, that's the world. So the panel I hosted was all these teams around the world that are giving gender equality commitments and taking on campaigns. You know, it was a soccer team in Tbilisi, Georgia. One in the Ukraine on my panel, New York rugby, the professional team, and, you know, Afghani soccer players. So it's there. That is my, you know, so now I think I can marry both.
You can.
And I am. But it took a really long time. And so, I just think if you focus, you're disciplined, and you just keep working at it and coming at it from every angle, you can get past that. But you got to be patient.
And I think sports helps teach you that, though, right?
It does. Well, yeah. Come at something from every angle and
from
keep
every
trying.
Angle, yeah. Especially from you. You talked about
yes.
how you watch tape. It's
yes.
preparation. How can I view this in a different way? How
all
can
the different, I, right, to make up for
angles.
What you lack. Like, whatever you're missing in your toolkit, I think most things, like, you know, certain things you can't. Like, I'm not going to ever jump 40
right.
inches. Like, that's just, I needed someone else's legs. Yeah,
yes.
You're like, but... Okay, yes, jumping's great, but if I know where that person's going to hit, like, or where their block is, I can hit around it. Like, you know, that kind of thing.
You can compensate for
and
other things.
The same with this work, going, okay, well, I know what, I have 10 years of direct victim services experience, so I don't have a PhD in this, but most of them don't have 10 years experience because they were busy getting their PhD.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So I would kind of go, well, how can I get at this? What do these people have in their toolkits? I can't do that. I'm not going to leave my job and go do a PhD, you know, at that time. And I don't think ever. But what can I how's another way to get at it? And I'm enjoying that part of my life now. As when you get to your 40s, it's about they talk about the second career. The career that you went into because you didn't know any better. Because you're like, well, I studied this. I should go into this, blah, blah, blah. And then you pick your head up and go, am I passionate about this? Not really. I don't pray at the altar of athletes. I don't. I don't care how famous or whatever. I just don't care. I like the work and I like my people. I like writing and speaking and doing that. But so where I am now is like a very interesting time in my life.
Well, I'm a few years ahead of you because
not many.
I've got a few years on you.
I've got a good skincare routine. So,
well, just from the standpoint of, I read a book called Halftime by Bob Buford, and it talks about that a lot of times you get caught up in getting down a path, and you don't realize it. That it's not what you really want to do.
It's not where your heart is.
It's not where your heart is. It's not meaningful. And that's what happened to me when I got out of coaching. That's where my heart was. Sports, coaching, and into pharmaceutical and medical device sales. And then I woke up.
Yeah, what am I doing?
A little over 40 years old. And I'm like, oh my goodness, wait a second. This is not what I thought my career path was going to be. And so it was really the genesis of starting the podcast. And
that's
now,
awesome.
You know, almost 3 years into it, I'm still like, I joke with my wife. I'm trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up, you know, because
I think a lot of people are going through that.
And it's crazy how that happens.
A lot of people going back to school, a lot of people doing kind of the gig economy, you know, leaving their jobs to go, you know, do flower shop or crafts.
Just something that your heart gets.
Well, we don't teach
up.
That in school. We talk about a job, but we don't talk about a career.
Exactly.
How to have a career and how to have, you know, do this thing called life.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's that our educational system is not.
Well, they're missing out on so many things. And one of the things I feel also is that they don't prepare you enough to really understand how valuable mentors are, connections, networking, all of that. It's like, oh, you just got to be laser focused, go get a job.
And it's weird because we're the ones that fund them. Like, we pay them to go there. You would think, be able to shape the curriculum.
That's right.
Like, I always say to kids when I talk, I said, you know, you go to school, you do all this, but, you know, you marry the wrong person too soon, you have a child before you mean to, whatever. All this is out the window.
That's right.
You know, all of a sudden, you have friends who married at 25, they're in a battle, their money, it doesn't matter what your education is.
It doesn't.
Nobody told them how to handle this, how to pick a partner, how to navigate, you know, single mother. Like, those are the things that are life. And college doesn't teach you life.
No, it
and
does
so
not.
And so you have your degree, and what are you going to, like, I know Kanye West did this song. What was it? He said, you can get your papers, but I, like, live in life or something.
Yes.
That's back when I listened to him. But but I think that's what he was saying is, okay, well, you've got this technical award, but you don't know how to do X, Y, and Z. And I think all of us are at that deficit. All of us, I said, God, I wish someone would have taught me how to, you know, pick a partner or how to navigate what, you know, I was attacked when I was in my early 30s. I went through an assault overseas and how to navigate that. And someone will say, well, that's just life. We can't accommodate for all those things. But I think there's general themes in terms of unexpected trauma. How to work through trauma. I mean, that is actually the theme, trauma. Like, we all are at some point,
we all face some type of trauma.
No one's unscathed.
That's right.
Nobody. By a certain age, someone has lost someone they love. Someone's been hurt horribly. Someone has, you know, died, been sick, like all these things. And we're all just like the walking wounded. And I can sit here and tell you how to write a press release, but how to, you know, be resilient and get back emotionally level set is, like, you know, we're all just trying to figure it out. In the self-help section at the bookstore, you know, if they still have bookstores.
And it's very difficult to navigate all of that because there's a lot of noise out there too.
So much noise.
And I try to tell my kids in terms of when I'm talking to you and giving you advice and some guidance, it's not from a perspective of that I'm talking down to you, that I'm better than you, that I haven't experienced it. It's just the opposite. It's because I've lived life longer than you have and I've experienced
all
certain
things,
you know, and trying to help guide them. Now, the other thing that I think is unique, and you touched on it, and especially with where your passion is right now, because the experience that you have, and then just the personal experience that you mentioned, the assault in Rome.
Yeah, I was attacked on the last night of my vacation. It was just they call it a brief encounter attack. It wasn't a total stranger. It's someone I met earlier with like a local cafe person that we'd gotten to know. I was over there for a few days, you know, and I love traveling and meeting people and hearing their stories. And anyhow, so this particular individual, you know, tried to rape me. He locked me in a six-floor apartment when I tried to exit. And I'd been very clear that I wasn't interested, you know, obviously in a sexual encounter with someone I didn't know. But
so you were setting boundaries?
Oh, from the start. Like, I was like, I'll go out with you, but just please know I do not want to sleep with you. Because at 32 or 31 at the time, I'm very easy to say that. You know, I think kids still kind of, when I talk to the college kids, they're like, like, why can you not say it? They're like, but they'd rather do anything but actually say, I don't want to do this. Yes, I do want to, you know, no problem at 31. And so I thought, oh, I checked the box. I had a curfew. My friend knows where I am. Like, I did all the things. And then you realize, like, none of that works. None of that actually cares. If someone's like, yeah, I don't care, I'm still going to do this
thing. All well and good.
Yeah,
but it gets thrown out the window.
We don't teach people what to do when someone rejects your no. That's the huge default in all this talk about rape prevention. Because I'll say to you right now. So say you have a daughter and you've told her all these things, and the guy says to her, no, I'm going to rape you. Now, what would you suggest you do?
Yell, fight back, do something.
Fight back?
Yes.
Fight back, you might kill her. It might have escalated the situation.
I don't know what else to say.
Right. Isn't that sad?
It is sad.
Mm-hmm.
Because that breaks my heart. Because
you don't know what to say.
I don't know what to say to my own daughter.
Right. And what you have to say to them is you'll know in that moment what's right for you. Because my own sister will say, I would just be very quiet and say, do what you need to do. Just don't kill me. I have kids. You know, that's what Kim Kardashian did when she was in Paris, when she got locked up and robbed. She said, I have kids. Do leave me. You know, so she wasn't sitting there swinging at anybody. This is this deficit in how we talk to people about this crime. And so there I am, and I was like, oh, I'm going to fight. This is going to be awful. I don't want to go through this. I can't. I don't want to go through this. This is going to hurt so bad, and I'm going to fight.
So you remember in your mind.
Oh, I remember everything.
This was.
Yeah.
You knew. You were thinking.
I would rather die than let this person do this. And that was just me.
So again, it's really personal.
Yes, it's very personal.
Each individual, how.
Yes, because for me to be brought to submission by a guy physically. Based on what I've told you.
Yes, from your history.
Can you not understand why it was just not, my response was like, hell no. Like that would, it was a sense of self-preservation because I knew if that happened, I think you would break my spirit. I don't think I'd ever recover from that. I knew what I had at stake.
Yeah, if this guy did that to you.
If this guy did it to me, I would never recover because it would upend everything I thought about myself. And so I fought and it was awful, but I did well. And, you know, I jumped off a balcony and climbed down all these buildings and got away. And then I pressed charges and hired an attorney and all that. But yeah, no, it was a really, it was, and the thing that I, the pivotal point in all of that, I knew I did nothing wrong. It was so ridiculous. I was like, I did nothing wrong here, like nothing. But what I did beat myself up about was like, what if I had just trusted my gut more, you know? And like, what if I...
Was there a moment that you felt something in
your
gut?
Yeah, well, yes, because I didn't really date much. So when he was just like, well, why don't you come see, his apartment was only two blocks from my hotel. And it was almost to my curfew. I had like 20 minutes. I said, oh, let's go sit on the Spanish steps. He said, no, why don't you come back? I'll show you. I'd already been up there earlier. We'd seen it. He has this big view of the cathedral and... It was a whole conversation we had, I don't bore you with. But anyhow, I had seen it. So I wasn't like afraid to go to the space and I knew how close by it was. So I didn't feel the fear. It wasn't like I couldn't get back from there, anything. But I did have a moment like, I don't really want to go. I'm tired. And if I just listened, but instead I felt like I was being rude. And this is what they call like the disease to please. They tell like, I didn't want to be rude to him. I didn't want to hurt his feelings. We'd had a nice night and I felt like I was being a jerk. I felt like I was being over with a lot of girls go, well, I don't want to be a jerk, but like, I don't want to go in that apartment with you because I don't know you. And then like the guy gets offended or they feel like, oh, so you're saying I'm a rapist. Like this is awful position we put women in. And basically when you say to someone, oh, no, 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 I spent a whole night with you, like around, but I don't want to be near you. like it introduces this element where you wind up feeling like the biggest jerk.
Like you're the bad guy.
Yeah, the bad guy. Yes. And I remember his face, like I was insulting him, and I'm like, my bad. Oh, sure, I'll go there. And I would just beat myself. Carrie, why did you do that? Why were you so weak? You're such a tough kid here, here, and here. Why are you so... That's what I was like destroying myself about on the perfection. Like, why were you... It wasn't about... It was never about clarity on if I invited it or anything, that bullshit. But it was really the lack of perfection in being who I was. And
do you feel you let your own self down?
That's what I was upset with myself for, because I had set the boundary, I'd done all the things, and I'm like, why would, you know? And that was my own private hell that I wasn't sharing with people. I was giving that, everyone's like, you're so strong, you're so tough, look at how badass you are, you did all these things. And so I wasn't going to sit there and be like, well, actually. But like inside, I was like, God, I cannot believe you are dealing with this right now. Like, I cannot believe you've just, if you had just not, like, you know, you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't have lawyers in Milan. You wouldn't be trying to go through your IRA account to see if you can pay for it. Like, if you had just been perfect, none of this mess. This upsetting your family, upsetting your friends, upsetting your work. Like, yes, not, like if you had just not been made this, like it just, yeah. And that's when you crash and then you wind up at a therapist's office. And that's how that happens. And then they start working with you.
Yeah, saying, dissecting what was the core.
Has this served
issue?
You? Does this thought serve you? No, it does not. Why didn't you say anything? Because you have a need to please people, to make them happy, which I did. Yeah. How I make them happy is by behaving well and being perfect at things, you know, and all that. It all comes home to roost at some point, too.
That's right. I mean, you can only keep it bottled up for so long.
Right. And
it has to come out.
And that's how it kind of came to a head. And so I'm much nicer to myself now. Much nicer.
How difficult was it to actually share that information? Because I know you've been very open about it and, telling people, and that's part of your journey right now.
I have always felt okay talking about it. I don't – and someone said to me, well, maybe if – because he didn't complete the rape. And I thought, that might be true. I'll never know.
You'll never know.
I'll never know. That might be true. But – I have such a sense of what happened was so A, not my fault, B, horrific. And how do I serve people? I can serve people by telling them exactly what's going to happen, that your body's going to shut down, that you're going to freeze, that you're going to feel like you're going to pee your pants in front of the person who's trying to harm you, that I want them to know the things that might go through your mind, you know? I had the opportunity to hit him over the head with this bottle of rum that was on the table that he had purchased earlier in the evening when we were out. He had turned around, and I remember thinking, oh, I can get the shot off. I can get the shot. I remember my left hand flinching to grab it, and I would have killed him. And then I thought, I will never make it out of Italy if I do that. He will be dead. He will not have raped me. And how will I explain?
How are you going to be able to prove that?
Yeah, right. Let's extrapolate this to the current conversation. Yeah. Oh, you know, women should get guns and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, we can't get them away for actual rape. Who is going to believe that you had to kill someone who didn't get a finger on you? To prevent it's the stupidest idea. And I knew Amanda Knox's case was going on at that time. And I thought, I'll never get out of here. Come in and kill. And they're like, you remember all that from your, I was like, oh, my brain was like.
And that's amazing that, because I know that's not a long period of time.
No, but I was so lucid.
You're still able to have those type of thoughts.
I had no alcohol in my body. Like I had a wine way earlier in the evenings. Like, you know, I was really sick at the time. I had bronchitis. So. That wasn't even really a factor, like, you know, drinking heavily. But I remember that, like, oh, I could kill him. And then later when I'm fighting for my life out on the patio, I'm like, why didn't I kill him? Why didn't I kill him? So it was just a very – and I tell people all those thoughts because, I could never kill someone. I'm like, well, actually I was one of those people that said I couldn't kill someone, and then it almost killed me. And then I'm like – you know, I almost died.
Obviously, it changes your perspective.
It changes my perspective.
And I've heard you talk about, too, that you think you know how you might respond.
Oh, you do. Yeah, but you don't.
But you don't, right?
No,
you don't.
No, this is
There's
the
just
other,
no way
this is
to
the
replicate
other lie.
That.
Listen, you will not know until you're in mortal danger. Mortal danger is a very specific set of circumstances where you actually believe you're going to die. Someone's trying to kill you, and you believe death is about
imminent.
To happen, imminent. You can't replicate that in any class. You can't think your way through it. What you can do with defense classes is think of like what you would do if you were locked in a room, what you would do, like, and keep thinking through those things. It helps you. So when you're in that instance, I thought of ways I need to get to an exit. If there's an exit available, take it. Like, I remembered that. But nobody can tell you how your body will respond. And a lot of people get the freeze. I just actually went through a corporate training, you know, for our company. We have these corporate trainings and talking about, you know, active shooters and stuff like that. There's nothing in the training that says, oh, by the way, your body might shut down and you might actually crack
just
your
stop.
Pants. Like,
yes.
Your body is going to release everything because yes. You're terrified.
Oh, there's plenty of stories of people in war that happens
well,
to
that's
them.
Where it comes from. That's where that term, like, that's literally where it comes from. War. It's the same thing. Your body under attack. That's what PTSD comes. That is a trauma. And the same thing about someone trying to rape or kill you. The same fear that you're about to lose, you know, your life. Most rape victims will say, I thought I was going to die. They all say that. And that's when the trauma comes in and then the PTSD after. And it's this ridiculous thing. Like, even in the training I'm watching, I'm going, it's saying, oh, run, throw something or do this. I'm going, where's the part where it's like, you are completely mobilized? Because what I want people to understand is know that that's probably going to happen and know what it is.
Yes.
Oh, that's what this is. Oh, this is a thing that's happening. That helps, you know. I was going, what is going on? Why can't I move? Carrie Potts, move your legs. Carrie Potts, why can't you? I'm yelling at myself in my head, the refrain I did as an athlete. I couldn't move my body. And I was trying to get to that door to get out, but I couldn't get my legs to move.
So when did it kick in? Adrenaline
it
or what happened?
It did. Yep. But I was fighting to keep all of my contents of my body in my body. I was like, am I going to like lose all of my waist? Like, right. It was the most embarrassing. Like, what is, it's awful. And then it just kicked in. Something just went, and I remember I felt like, I always say, I feel like I had the strength of 10 men or 10 women. And then I was like a fiend, like an absolute out of control, just like, I will end him. I will get to that balcony. I will jump. I was punching him. I was knocking, like, and even when I was leaping down the buildings and jumping, I'm going 15 feet, 10 feet, 15 feet, like, I remember some vague stinging in the front of my shins, but that's the only feeling I felt, the only sensation, because
the adrenaline.
Yeah,
was
and I was
in.
Jumping right. So far, the concrete was like going up through my shin, and that would anybody would feel agony from that. But all I could feel was just like a little tingle, you know, and you don't feel anything. Like it's beautiful. Our bodies are so amazing.
Amazing, aren't they?
What they do. But the aftermath of that was like I couldn't move. The next day, my fingertips felt like they're broken. Every part of me, I would just cry and shake because I had bruises everywhere. I mean, it was just – and my shoulder. Everything was a mess. And so it was just one of those life moments, and I feel like I felt such urgency to have to tell people about all that. I don't see that in a lot of these reports. We write about women and victims still very much like we're in a corner, you know, sucking our thumb. And I mean that like in a catatonic way. And I think they're trying to be sympathetic and stuff. But it doesn't give you a lot of space for people like me. And so I was like, is this normal that I'm not like devastated? Like, I'm pissed.
Yeah, you're mad.
I'm pissed.
Yeah.
I'm upset at what could have happened. But I'm like so mad. This is so unjust. And also, why didn't anyone tell me this about the freeze? Why didn't anyone tell me that when they say no to – I laid out all the boundaries and he still said no. Well, what the hell then? Like, why aren't we telling people this? To this day, we don't tell them what to do. I ask – every time I ask, especially a father, okay, tell me what you're going to tell her to do. Oh, fight. Well, what if the freeze? He's fighting incites them. Some of them, that's what is the difference between living and not. You know, depends on the type. There's a sadistic type of rapist. There's, you know, the opportunistic type. And that might be the thing he's looking for. So you got to figure out how to answer that question. I would recommend everybody listening to this figure out how to answer that question.
Please. Where can we find out that type of information to help us get to an answer?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people who've done research on this. But honestly, it kind of goes back to what I say. You have to say to your daughter, yourself, your wife, whatever, even you, your subject, anyone has a gun or you're asleep or incapacitated, you are susceptible to anything, okay? And men are told – that is the lie that you guys all operate under. You know, like, you're as vulnerable as anybody else. Look at our military. We have so many military men that suffer this crime. you will figure it out in that situation. Whatever it is that you do to survive is the right thing for you. Okay? And that might mean your daughter says, Dad, I just let him. But our courts punish you for that. Oh, well, you didn't fight.
You didn't fight.
Oh, what am I going to do with a 200? My guy was like 70 pounds heavier than me. What am I going to do in that scenario? Oh, so I'm going to die? Am I going to break? What would you like to see? You know, you wouldn't be there if he wasn't threatening you. You wouldn't lay down if you didn't think you were going to die. Like our laws say that's the threat. That's
yes,
the physical. Right. But juries and everyone wants to see markings. And so many people have the freeze and just please stop. And we're so horrible to them for that. We want what they saw with me. And so I do have guilt about that when I talk. I try to say to people, please know, I know my case is very, very different than a lot. And I'm not here to wave myself around with you. What I'm here to talk to you about is this other stuff. Like, don't ever think you have to jump over buildings and hand fight a guy. Like, you're not me. You're not angry like I am. You're not big like I am. And you're not like so overconfident in my body like I am, you know? And, you know, so I'm careful about that because I don't want people to think that's the only way or that's the right way. You will know in that instance.
In that moment.
Your brain and your body will tell you. And you have to, as a person supporting them, you have to be okay with whatever that looks like.
Exactly.
But people say, why did you fight? Why would you lay there? Why would you, and it's.
And I imagine there's people that are shamed.
Of course.
To that point.
They are.
That
I didn't
fight. You can't
tell
me you didn't fight.
Right.
What are you thinking? You got to get out of
that
situation.
Well, because that's what we reward. Oh, they rewarded me. Oh, she's such a badass. You're so, God, Carrie, how'd you, we're not saying it to the people. God, you survived. Congratulations. You got through that. We don't give them that. And that's the majority by far. So that, and we fall down on that too. I mean, I could go on that for hours, but anyhow, sports.
Well, I was going to say, have you ever thought about that, when this adrenaline kicks in and you've got this.
Well, I knew what that was. I knew what it is when adrenaline kicks in. I trust my body because I know I've been in those.
Been in sports.
Yes. I've been in matches where you get that. There's actually a video of it. One of our matches against Pittsburgh was like almost 3 hours. This is before rally scoring when we had side out scoring. So a match could last 3.5 hours.
Yeah, just keep going.
5 games, 3.5 hours. And you're just on fumes. And I remember I wanted to end that match. And there's this thing, you just see me like, give me the ball. And like, it's a burning sensation all the way. I'm on fire. Like if you took my temperature, it would be jacked, and I'm just like a fiend, I would say. And I know what that feeling is. And so I remember a moment going, I know what this is. Like, I cannot ever replicate that level of adrenaline. Like when you think you're going to die, like it's way more than sports. Like it's what it should be. It should never be something other used than used for that moment, right?
That, yes, exactly. Reserved just for that.
Just for that. And I think that I remember going, oh, yeah, I know what this is. Like, I know this feeling, like the shaking that comes. So that shaking was the adrenaline starting to go through because I was standing there looking at him and I was just like this. And it was the adrenaline just firing through. And all of a sudden I was like, and boom, just went at him. And yeah, and I remember going, oh, I know what this is. And I think a lot of people who don't train their bodies through sports, who don't have that advantage, don't know what that is. It's horrifying. Your body's like emptying.
And I would imagine it just magnifies the point of, well, I just got to freeze because I don't know what's happening.
Yes.
Because they're just getting confused.
Yes. You're confused. You don't understand what's going on. And you don't trust yourself. Like, I trust my body. I trust myself more than I trusted him to let me out of that space.
I can imagine.
I thought, I can do this. I can climb. There's space close together. This is not skyscrapers. These are all old houses. I can dive, jump, roll. I can do this. I think I can. And that was a confidence that you get from sports. And that's what I say sports saved my life, because it taught me how to believe in my body and myself and my strength, and taught me how to think about navigating spaces. Gymnastics, I know how to roll. I know how to hit the floor without actually hurting myself. And that carried on into volleyball. I know how to go up and hit a ball hard and then pull my body back so I don't make a net violation. I know how to control my abdomen. I know how to, those were all the things that came into play that night. And I am so grateful for that. I don't know what the outcome would have been. If you don't have high body confidence and don't trust and know how you're going to react and what you're capable of, then that's not an option available to you.
That's right. And again, I think that just, you freeze.
Yeah.
Even more so. Now, have you thought about also just in terms of, we all have different pathways and journeys. And again, how some are positive, some are negative, but it's how you utilize those for other things, just like you're doing now. Have you thought about that? What you went through was part of your journey, so
absolutely.
You could be on
this
mission now of what you're doing.
I remember exactly where I was in the street after the police had brought me back to show them where I had entered the building and maybe where I'd exited, which I was struggling to figure out. And there was a bunch of things that happened, but it felt like divine intervention. There were just inexplicable things that happened, a series of things that happened in that 24-hour period that you cannot explain. And I remember looking up at the sky and saying to God, I said, oh, I got it. Yep. You want me to sound the alarm. I remember saying that. And I was walking with the probably 6 or 7 police, like plainclothes, back to the cars. It became very clear that God wanted me to, I would say it's like being waterboarded to the point of drowning, but not. Like, he brought me right up to the edge to see what it's like to have someone ignore your boundaries, what it's like to have someone terrorize you, what it's like to believe this is about to happen, I'm going to die. And what it's like to deal with the police and go through questioning and have witnesses who didn't at first want to come forward because they didn't want to get involved in the bureaucracy there. And like, you know, and then not have me raped. So he preserved my ability to go on in life, you know, like not have me unjust. Like I got, Marco wrote, yeah, I did this. He pled guilty, you know, so I got the thing that most no one ever gets, right? So that I could go and tell people these things and then I could go do the work. And it's so obvious. And anyone would tell you that. It's so obvious. I've always had big, broad shoulders. I'm the one to do this work. I am the right temperament and toughness, but with enough sensitivity because of what I experienced. And yeah, so it was exactly as it was supposed to be.
God built you for this.
Right, because
he knew you could handle it.
Right, but if I had been raped in that way, I would not be
here. Maybe it would have been
different. I would not be here. It would have just, and that's why that couldn't happen, you know? I don't think I would have survived that emotionally. I would not have survived that. It would have just shattered everything. And I think, you know, obviously God knows that too. So, and I have to say, I say God because like I grew up a Lutheran. But you know, when you get older, it's like I go on Christmas and Easter. I'm from New York, so it's different down here in the South. But I always just talk to God. I always had this very like, We have a conversation every day. I'm like, listen, what is going on? And and so that, you know, but when you're in a place like Rome, it's so ever present. Like you feel like angels are just flying everywhere. Like it was like the show, right? Think about it. You step in there, you're like, oh my God, there's angels everywhere. Everything about that was just so, I'm certain that what happened to me was for all the things that have come after. And I don't, you know, I'm very careful about speaking about, you know, organized religion and all that because victims are of all types. I will never want someone not talk to me, trust me because I'm this and not that, because it doesn't care. It doesn't care. And so when I say I speak to God, everyone has a God, unless you're atheist, which is fine too. But yeah, so I do believe that I was called to do the work. And
that's an amazing story. It
is
really
crazy.
Is.
One day I will write. I've been working on like a book about it because there's so much I never tell people because it just never fit in this conversation. You know, I could go on for hours about it, every detail. Even when that magazine article I wrote, they cut out so much because they had to get it on 4 pages, you know. And so, yeah, someday.
Yeah, I don't even know if you could confine it even.
No.
I know it's just so ever present.
I've had people try to buy my life, right?
It is.
Like several times. And I was like, no, I'm the only one that's going to tell this story. You know, I don't want, when you have to sign a life rights thing, it's like, oh, well, we can replace you. We can make you a man. We can make you a, you know, this and this. We could, I'm like, no.
No, that's not your
journey. No, why would
journey?
I sign
that's
that?
Not your story.
I said to the woman, if you take that out, I will sign it. Oh, well, no. No. I don't need any creative assistance in telling this story. It tells itself.
It does tell itself.
It does. If you know all the part, or most of it, yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, that was just like last year. Every time someone comes at you with that, you have to hire an entertainment attorney and look through the contract and then send, you know. And I finally just said, I'm going to do it. So I'm working on the book.
Okay, we'll have another podcast
yes.
when the book comes
yes.
out,
yes.
all right?
Yes.
One last question.
Sure.
I'm a big words of wisdom type of person. Mottos, quotes, phrases, just life advice. Do you have anything that has meant a lot to you?
There's two. Okay. And one is my mother's that I have borrowed. And the other one is a poem that always really connected with me when I was little by Christopher Marlowe. And but my mom's first one is "To thine own self be true." Really, you become who you are as you get older. And I really am feeling "to thine own self be true" with what we're talking
Especially
about.
Especially as you get older.
With you doing this podcast. That's the "to thine own self be true." And the other one is there's a poem and it's "My mind to me a kingdom is, there in perfect joy I do find." And I travel by myself. I just went to Montreal, actually, just to have some downtime. I went to London in the beginning of the year. Like, my mind to me, I enjoy my inner world. I love history. I love reading. I travel and I will go without talking to anyone for 7 or 8 days. And I'm really good on my own. And I like myself. Like, I like what I have to say. Fascinated by it. No.
But you can entertain your own self. Right.
But I loved – that was the thing. The kids in high school were all doing the, you know, the social strata and the this and the that. And I was perfectly happy. You know, my mind to me came there in perfect joy. I'm peaceful. I like myself. I when people say, why do you go on vacation by yourself? I'm like
– I need that.
I mean, there I was in London on the shore with a bottle of red – chocolate, cheese, a book on Richard III, and a blanket by the water. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. Like, what?
That's heaven for you.
This is so good. You know? So that's the other thing I always think and go, to this day, it has never been more true.
Well, how important it is to know your own self.
People do a lot of things to not have to spend time with themselves.
That's
they
right.
do a lot of out with other people. They don't want to be a
Because they feel
like,
that's what they have to do.
There's something you don't want to address, I believe. And that's fine. You can be a people person, but I just think if you're that terrified of like spending time with yourself, like there's a therapist for that. I probably know them.
Gary, thank you so much.
Thank you. I hope I was helpful. I just rambled.
100%.
Okay. I know it's supposed to be a conversation, so yeah.
Yes, it was a great conversation.
Good.
I've learned a lot, and I greatly appreciate you being so open and honest.
Thank you for being interested in having me. I saw your list. It's a knockout roster.
Well, now it is with you.
Oh, yeah. Clearly. Highest engagement ever.
The biggest star ever, Gary Potts, on the Rich Take on Sports podcast.
That's right.
Gary, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Hopefully, most of us will never have to learn how we would respond in the face of imminent danger like Carrie did that night. But what an amazing story of survival, and just how unique it was that something that she has always loved, sports, that physical movement, and the understanding of how her body moves, that would ultimately, as Carrie described, help save her life. And it's clear that she's uniquely built to carry this torch to help so many other victims while always being true to herself. Now that finishes episode 131, and more of our conversations can be found on your preferred podcasting platform. And you can also watch some of our episodes by visiting our Rich Take on Sports YouTube channel, where you can easily subscribe. And remember, focus forward so we don't live in the past. All the best, everyone.
You've been listening to Rich Take on Sports, the sports podcast with life. Visit richtakeonsports.com to subscribe and catch up on any episodes you might have missed. You can also follow us on Twitter @RichTakeSports. Thanks for listening.